Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
It shines, it shimmers in the blackness, in the night. It is in the blackness of night that the light of a dream shines. The visibility of its light depends on darkness, darkness that in turn depends on the light to draw out its significations from a void. Dreams and darkness hold each other in Mesoamerican space-time, like the intersecting warp and weft in a weaving.
Thanks for joining me. I am speaking here today with Edgar Garcia, a poet and scholar of literatures and cultures of the Americas at the University of Chicago. We're here today, Edgar, to talk about your new book, Signs of the Americas. And this is kind of a tough book for me to summarize for a whole range of reasons, but I tried my best to put it in a sentence. So here's my go at it, okay? Signs of the Americas is about the forms of knowledge and sign systems developed by the indigenous peoples of the Americas, and it explores how these sign systems acquired a new kind of legibility in and through the work of creative writers in the 20th century, people like Gloria Anzaldúa and William Burroughs and Gerald Vizinor. And the tension in the book then is about that it's both about these sign systems and about the transformations and the revisitings of these sign systems, the remakings of these sign systems by writers in the 20th and 21st century. Does that sound like an accurate summary to you?
Absolutely. It's a great description of the book. And I just want to clarify that when you say sign systems, we're talking very literally about sign systems, that is the non-alphabetical forms of inscription native to the Americas, like pictographs or picture writing, hieroglyphs, and Andean knot writing, known as quipu. And the way you describe it is perfectly resonant with how I think about it, which is an attempt to show that these are not at all dead sign systems, as some people tend to think about them, but very much a part of a living present, whose life is found in contemporary literature and art, but also beyond aesthetic practices in contemporary legal thinking and environmental activism. And the story that the book tells is the story of the present life of these sign systems in 20th and 21st century thinking in the Americas.
Great. And just for listeners who might not know the distinctions between a pictograph and a hieroglyph, can you just give us a kind of soapbox, you know, 1 minute idea of what these distinctions are?
Yeah, I can try. So a pictograph, as I say in the book, is more metonymic than a hieroglyph because its symbol points off the page to a narrative that doesn't necessarily exist in relation to the image at hand, but by mnemonic association connects back to a story that a person or a group of people have been transmitting and transforming over a broad stretch of time. The hieroglyph is a lot closer to the alphabet. It's kind of a bridge system between pictographs and alphabetical writing, in that although it has some of that associative even evocative mnemonic prompting. It also has hard relationships between visual symbols and sounds, right, in the way that the alphabet works.
Right. Okay. That's super helpful, or at least it clears things up for me. And if listeners, of course, want to go into more detail about these distinctions, they can go pick up the book. But I think now I'd like to move on and to ask you how you began to study these Mesoamerican forms of knowledge. What was it something that you came across first in school? Did you grow up around this stuff? Just how did you get interested in this?
It definitely was not something I ever saw in school, and that is just a testament to the limited pedagogies that we have around teaching the history of the Americas in the school systems of the Americas. I grew up in California to a Central American family who came to the United States, migrated to the United States, fleeing wars in El Salvador and Guatemala. And it was very much a Central American household in a lot of ways. We spoke Spanish. We ate Central American food. We carried the cultural fabric in all the ways that you imagine migrant families do. But in one very important way, we did not, and that was through historical relation. My family very much wanted to forget that history. It was a very hard history in which they lost a lot of loved ones, and the trauma was very present. So that there was that classical sense of disconnect between my understanding of what Central America was and what Central America was to them. And my coming to these forms of knowledge, as you put it, modes of inscription, creation, understanding, perception, feeling, was very much born out of a desire to connect, to build that fabric again that had been torn. And then in going back to Guatemala and El Salvador, in seeing still torn in a lot of ways, and wanting to embrace what is there and what is here in the Americas, to give it a theoretical voice and to make it as privileged as the knowledge systems that we inherit from Europe and European descended cultures.
And do you remember a particular moment in time or an event that spurred you to take on this particular task? Or was it more like something that sort of was gestating for a while before you actually started to write it?
It was in graduate school, very late, when I had gone there as a medievalist. I'd been a medievalist as an undergraduate, studying philology and Latin and Romance languages, and had gone to graduate school to do early American studies. I had this idea to do a poetics of the Americas through John Adams and Thomas Jefferson. But then in graduate school, my grandmother died, and during her time of dying, I went to El Salvador to spend some time with her there, and the flood of reconnection hit me, and I asked myself, why am I not trying to build this tapestry again? Why am I not trying to tell these stories? Why am I not embracing the massively complex and dynamic and knowledge-bearing fruits that this world has to offer? So I came back from that trip and really just changed my educational outlook and decided to focus on the Americas, to study the signs of the Americas.
That's amazing. I mean, that's... you know, having just finished my own graduate work, I mean, just the boldness and self-knowledge that it takes to be able to stop like that and say, you know, what I'm really passionate about is not what I've been, you know, trained in up until this point, and I need to retrain myself. That's a tough decision to make.
Thanks. And it may seem tough, but it was also just somewhat inevitable. I couldn't go on doing the things that no longer inspired me. And I found something that did, in fact, inspire me. And I just had to pursue it. There was no getting around it. And it wasn't easy to change a project mid-career, let's say, or, you know, mid-graduate school, in as much as that wasn't, you know, that wasn't what I arrived to do. And there wasn't really anybody there trained to help me do it. And I had, you know, support in a lot of ways, and were people that helped me. And then I I picked up this tome by the late, great ethno-poetic scholar Dennis Tedlock called 2,000 Years of Mayan Literature. And the title itself says it all, right? 2,000 years of Mayan literature. How could there be 2,000 Mayan years of Mayan literature if we're only thinking about literature in terms of alphabetical inscription? And Dennis's whole point in that book is to lay bare the fact that literature can happen in so many other modes, modalities, textual systems, sign systems. And it was that book. And I reviewed it without knowing Dennis at that time. And I reviewed it and I got an email from him a few days after I reviewed it, and it came out on Jacket 2, that review, saying, you are the ideal reader for my book. And it's not because I knew everything that he was talking about, but I understood the spirit.
The chaos of the world is incomplete and imperfect because it is a chaos of worlds. And each world has its own structures, forms, rhythms, and orders by which it organizes and gives meaning to chaos. In considering whether the pictograph will show up in this panorama, this book affirms that there are topographies other than the singular abyss of capitalist modernity to consider. When a person is forced to mark out their meaning amid a stream of changing semiotic regimes, it is not necessarily the case that the sign with more military might behind it conquers. The repertoires of pictography, hieroglyphs, and quipu demonstrate how signs and the worlds of their tropes persist. And they persist because they continue to problematize, forcing a reconsideration of social categories, figural logics, disciplinary norms, and even what constitutes objects and situations, aesthetic, political, and otherwise.
That story that you just told, in a way, already begins to answer this question. But I wanted to maybe begin to get into the book a little bit, to focus in on the first sentence, really, where you say that it is a common misconception that the era of the pictograph is over. And I guess I just want you to spell out for us a little bit why that's wrong. I mean, what's wrong with saying that pictographs are a thing of the past? What is it really a misconception that the era of the pictograph is over?
What's wrong with saying the era of the pictograph has come to a close? Well, that it's simply not true. There is an abundance of creative and critical work, and not just poetry, but legal philosophy even, coming out now, that shows the important value of pictographic writing and thinking. So one of the exciting moments in writing this book, doing the research for it, was encountering the work of Anishinaabe attorney and legal scholar John Burroughs in Canada, whose main research question is how to create multi-juridical legal cultures in the federal Canadian system. And how to do that in such a way that Indigenous law isn't seen as secondary or beneath Canadian federal law and isn't seen as merely customary, but is understood to be interacting with it in dynamic and equal ways. What Burroughs proposes is that pictographic inscription can, in fact, help with that effort, in as much as, you know, mentioned to you before, the pictograph takes the law off the page and puts it into the context of the conversation around the law that might be happening in a given room. And he's extremely literal about this. He's not saying the pictograph in a metaphorical sense. He has this wonderful book called Drawing Out Law, in which each chapter begins with a pictograph that he has made to represent a particular legal problem in Canada right now, and explores the legal problem through a kind of pictographically mediated case study analysis. So that is to say, pictograph has things to teach us that the alphabet cannot, in the same way that the alphabet has things to teach us that the pictograph cannot. And Burroughs in no way is proposing that we abandon alphabetical inscription, but merely pointing to another resource for human intellection. And in that doing, disrupting a chronology that colonialism imposes upon its colonized subjects, which is that what we do is the new, right? And what you do is the old. And everything that you've done is superseded by what we bring. And that's a chronology that gets played out even in our understandings of the history of language, moving from picture to the end of history, as it were, with the alphabet, which is just not the case in so many ways.
All right, so I think it's time that we get down into some details. I'd like to give the listeners concrete examples of the sort of work they'll encounter when they buy Signs of the Americas. So let's start with Jaime de Angulo. This was one of the characters who really popped off the page for me. For one thing, he just had a totally crazy, fascinating life story. It involves anarchists, cowboys, Ursula Le Guin's father, sex changes, and no small amount of personal tragedy. But de Angulo is probably best known for this collection of indigenous narratives that was published under the title of Indian Tales. Though, as you point out, the publishers actually butchered the work by cutting all the pictographs out of it. Obviously, we can't show those pictographs here, but de Angulo did record a number of these tales, so we have an opportunity to hear them read out in his own voice. So would you set up this little clip for us? Would you tell the listeners, you know, what it is that they're about to get into?
So what the listeners are going to hear are a radio broadcast that de Angulo did at the end of his life as he was dying of cancer. He very much saw it as the culmination of his life's work. The frame story, as it were, is that it is a family of animals who are traveling from their home in the mountains to the coast. And along the way, they meet other animal groups and learn the cultural ways of these other animal groups as they go along, imparting their own cultural ways and putting the different cultural ways into conversation, interaction. So it has all these kinds of anthropological moments. A lot of the work is based on Jaime de Angulo's own anthropological work in the indigenous cultures of the California, Oregon lands. And it is being translated into these stories that take place in the animal worlds that those stories themselves tell. Right? So it's like if you were collecting a myth, you didn't tell the myth as the anthropologist reporting what somebody said to you. You told the myth from the perspective of the people in the myth themselves. So Fox Boy telling the story, Turtle Old Man telling the story, Old Man Coyote telling the story.
But about the moons, we have different names for each one. We start with the moon of the marmot, then the moon of the ground squirrel. That's when the winter is coming to an end. And pretty soon the people will be able to get out of the winter house, at last, and go to the hills. And then, in summertime, and later, we name the moons by the deer. When the deer are turning red, when the deer are running, when the deer drop their antlers, and so on. And then, in midwinter, we name two moons, one after the other, by the same name. We call it the bad moon, Hokai Tsul, because that's the worst time of the year. And every fourth year, we drop one of them, so as to make it come right again. What do you mean, make it come right again? Why, sure, 10 and 2 moons would not be enough to make a whole year, and 10 and 3 moons is too much. So we have 10 and 3 moons, and every 4 years we drop one. I don't see how you people manage it to make it come right. With 10 and 3 moons always, Your night moon must be getting way ahead of your sun moon. Bear looked puzzled. Grizzly looked puzzled too. But Grandfather Coyote was smiling to himself. He said, "Ask Antelope. Maybe she knows."
So, help us make sense of what's happening in this clip. I mean, maybe the place to start even before we get into the content is the voice that seems sort of cultivated to put you in a certain kind of mood. You talk about his enunciative apparatus in the book. What would you have to say about his voice?
It is enunciative in a lot of ways. He's performing, he's bringing to life vocal plurality within his animal world that he's constructed. But it's also very much an inheritance of his own linguistic plurality as a very adept speaker of more than two dozen indigenous languages, as well as a native French-Spanish speaker who learned his English in British Honduras, as I understand it, and therefore has that almost Caribbean sound that you hear at times, all coming through at once in this kind of vocal heterogeneity. So that's what I would say about the voice. As far as the content, what we're hearing here is the evocation of cultural difference in an indigenous context. So that is to say that it's not just that indigenous is put as the other to the Western, but here you have something like what Chadwick Allen has called the trans-indigenous, Pomo and Miwok and Achumawi conceptions of time and world form as organized by the movements of the moon across the sky, being put into conversation and difference with one another. Oh, you don't count the moons that way? Well, we count them this way. How do you make them make sense? Well, we make them make sense this way, which serves to remind us that there are so many ways to organize time, none of which in any culture, time is compelled to respect our ways of organizing it, right? Like the moon resists our systems, and we have to tweak our systems and make it not work when it should, and introduce other tweaks to make the moon make sense. And to me, that is very much at the heart of one of the things that interested me in researching for this book, which is to understand world form. An indigenous world form, especially in relation to time, and how time, which I translate in the book in terms of rhythm, is what worlds are made out of. Right? How you organize the rhythms of your day is directly related to the music, the poetry that you live in, as well as the various institutional rhythms that you inhabit or are captured by.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and Dangulo's tales, the rhythm is thematized at other points with the animals, you know, different cycles of lives, and even with songs that they can't get in the right rhythm to. And so this gets directly into this question that I'm sure is at the back of a lot of people's minds, which is a question, I guess, about the politics of form and about, you know, these categories that we often use when we're talking about someone like Dangulo, maybe not exactly like Dangulo, because who could be like him, but someone who is coming and what we would often say sort of appropriating or fetishizing indigenous imagery or indigenous languages for their own purposes. You know, this is something that we, I think, quite rightly are often taught to be suspicious of. And I wanted to ask you how you think that focusing on the form of this work can help us get at a better way of talking about what counts as a good or bad engagements with the colonial archive or with these indigenous thought systems.
I don't come down in either direction in that question, because colonialism doesn't stop. Right? Colonialism doesn't stop for however many explanations you give for various anthropological projects. But the way in which you construe it and understand it really makes a difference for the life you're giving to the work or the life that you're taking away from it. And the taking away of life from indigenous cultural systems, as they appear in this book, as I understand it, is in thinking about them only as content to be understood or criticized by European theoretical form, right? That is, through logics even of appropriation, which often are foreign to the object that you're trying to understand to begin with. So what I have tried to do in the book is to think about, well, what is the form then? Right? How is this work helping me to see it and also to see its interaction beyond its, let's say, original site of creation, elicitation, and also beyond anything it could have imagined it would encounter in its moment of originary making. So that is to say, how do the forms inform a bigger world consciousness than one that we arrived at when we came to it? How do we not impose, even in our social criticism, even in our social critique, a totalizing understanding of what is a world, a singular modernity, onto any of these works? And in putting those two elements into play, that is, the social critique and the aesthetic, or the critical and the creative, I've been enormously aided by the theoretical systems of the Americas themselves. So one big theory that the book works with is non-synthesizing dialectic, as I found in Mesoamerican, that is to say, Mayan, Aztec, Nahuatl philosophy. And by non-synthesizing dialectic, I mean really understanding of contradiction as never resolving into synthesis. An appreciation for the constant tensioning of opposed parts, and how that tensioning is a source of mutability and life energy. And that way of thinking really helped to situate some Western theory philosophy for the book, and it's how I arrived to Walter Benjamin, and how Walter Benjamin's own desire to stay in the opposition, to stay in the contradiction, started to make sense to me. So Walter Benjamin's appearance in the book was a way of translating Mesoamerican form.
Right, right. Yeah, it sounds to me like, if I could try and say back to you what I hear you saying, is that in some ways, rather than looking for a sort of original that is being, taken or grabbed, you're asking, you know, are people attending to the supplement that's already there inside of the thing that's being engaged with, or are there ways in which the sort of the paraliterary space that these objects produce, are people occupying that paraliterary space in a way that is enlivening or desiccating?
Yeah, absolutely. One way to think about it, to give put an object on the table, is through the Popol Vuh, the Mayan story of creation. This is a new project that I have now, working on a book about the Popol Vuh. And one thing that fascinates me and animates me about the Popol Vuh, this Mayan story of creation, many people have probably heard of it, heard it referenced in one way or another. It's had an abundance of translation, adaptation in 20th and 21st century American and Latin American culture and literature. One thing that people may not know about that book is how completely enwrapped in colonial history its intextualization was. So it's transcribed, the text that we have, the manuscript that we have today, was transcribed by a colonial friar in 1701 with the intent that the work that was being transcribed would be used to better convert the natives, to better convert the Mayans. The way it was bound was within what I call a colonial fact book, which is the languages into which the missionaries were going to embark on their mission, a literal art of evangelization, the Popol Vuh, and then a commentary on the Popol Vuh that basically tells the missionaries, don't get it wrong, this is devilish and dumb. You are there to convert the natives. This work that we are collecting here is simply to help you in that project. And what's really fascinating about the Popol Vuh, the text itself that's bound in this colonial fact book, which is held at the Newberry Library in Chicago, by the way, what's really fascinating is that its Mayan writers understand this all and include this story in the Popol Vuh. The Popol Vuh starts now in the time of Christendom, now in the time of Christianity, when we can no longer see this and when our world can no longer that, and when this and this. You know, we will make the world happen, right? And then the creation story happens, right? So there is the absolute reckoning with colonial fact while not letting go of the possibility for indigenous world making that the substance of the book then goes on to give you. And the main way in which that book describes itself, it calls itself this in two moments at its very beginning and at its very end, is an instrument of seeing, right? An instrument of seeing. The world, the Mayan world will be recreated. The world of the Popol Vuh will be recreated when people see this way again. Right? If there isn't another synonym, a better synonym for theory, for form, I can't think of one, right? It's talking about itself as theory, as form, as a world-defining conceptual system. Niña pillan tu eres el oro, 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 pillan, pillan, pillan. Tu eres el oro, niña pillan, volcán, pillan, oro, oro. Tu eres el oro, tu eres el oro, pillan, volcán, pillan, volcán, niña pillan.
So maybe, I mean, I don't know if we'll have time, but let's talk about Anzal Dua and Al Yurista, because I personally was really thrilled to see them in this book. And I was really excited to see that you were reclaiming these figures, maybe not reclaiming, I don't want to push that word on you, but giving a rereading to these figures who had such an important role to play in the Chicano and Latinx liberation movements of the 60s and 70s and 80s. And precisely because of their way of sort of mythic thinking that has often been criticized as fetishistic, right, or flattening, and using the new kind of theoretical framework that you yourself have derived from the Mesoamerican thought, you arrive at a new way of thinking about some of their work. So maybe we could talk, should we talk about Al Yurista first or Anzal Dua first? Who would you prefer to?
Either one. I think Anzal Dua might be more recognizable to more people as a name. She's definitely someone that is a lot messier than most people think she is as a theoretical, intellectual, spiritual thinker. I think people have a sense that they know where Anzal Dua falls in a chronology of post-colonial feminism, and they know what Anzal Dua is supposed to represent in terms of that chronology. But when you actually get down to read the published works and then the unpublished or the recently published but hitherto unpublished works, like Light in the Dark, you realize there's something a lot wilder and weirder happening here, not only in terms of the post-colonial and the feminist, but also indigenous studies, conceptions of what is Chicanx, that I wanted to let her, for herself, bring to light in the work.
I catch a glimpse of a face in a store window, watch its color recede, and realize that it is my face. I no longer look the same. Light radiates from me and my body hums. I do not look like those I left behind, nor have I become a translucent criatura or a faceless chalk. I don't want to be one of them. I just want to comprehend this world, but the more I enter into it, the more it slips away. Under my feet, the ground shifts. An oppressive thickness hangs in the air, too heavy to breathe. I gasp and sway with fatigue. Mal aire. I've inhaled the spirits of the wind. Why am I here in this alien world, en Nepantla, el lugar del aislamiento, confronted by creatures who threaten me with their strangeness? I am afraid I will forever be alone, forever unlike others, just like I was before in el otro lugar, en Napantla, el lugar entre medio, the place in between.
And what that ended up producing in letting Anzal Dua speak for herself, as it were, was somebody who's not as concerned with identity formation as she's typically understood to be, but much more with identity deformation, destabilization, derangement, not just in terms of content, but in terms of form, right? In the form of her writing, in the way in which she's constantly destabilizing what she has just said, contradicting herself three pages on, coming back to a previous contradiction and following it through as a seeming stabilization, only to disrupt it, confusing parts for wholes and wholes for parts and here and there. It's a Mesoamerican poetic form, theoretical form being enacted rather than explicitly described in her works. And this gets back to that issue that I have had and tried to push against, which is to only ever think about writing by minoritized, subalternized, indigenous, or otherwise peripheralized people in terms only of content, right? And instead, to think about it in terms of form. Right? What is the form-bearing shape of this work? And how does this work not only shed light on itself, but on other works too? So how does, indeed, Gloria Anzal Dua help us to read Walter Benjamin or William Burroughs or Michael Taussig?
Yeah, the way you just said it reminded me of this passage from your beautiful work of poetry, Skins of Columbus, where you this term, the complementary contradictions that are central to the forms of thought that are embodied in these mythical systems, not just in the content of the systems, but in the forms of expression and thought. And I was wondering if you have that quote there with you, if you could just read to us this passage of where you speak of the core beings of the mythological systems of Mesoamerican culture.
Yeah, it begins with the distance in time. The distance in time. The distance in time that separates the era of the flayed god from that of Sipitio is a constant temporal condition of colonized people, is the embodiment of distances, is the intimacy of time's breaks, where the deer-hoofed dogs push through their ensorcelled snouts, make explicit their consciousness of contradiction, and thus declaim themselves fleshy theory and technique, configuration as such. There is no going back, only to mark out those instances in which the times do not cohere, errors and wrecks marbled like crystal into earth bed, when a little bird flies into the room to remind you of the geothermic tension between temporalities that is, under your slipping hooves, the field of political and social possibility.
Yes, yes. We will definitely have to include some links on there for people to be able to find that book, because it was a very rich experience for me to be able to go back and forth actually between Signs of Columbus, or Signs of the Americas and Skins of Columbus, because the way in which all of these works are, you know, evoking the continuities between the dream space and the myth space and the magical space and the creative space, to just focus on the sort of purely rationalistic discourse that one can create about them is to somehow to miss to miss the invitation that they're putting out to us.
Thanks for letting me draw on some of the creative work and the poetry too, because as you notice, the critical and the creative are totally intertwined for me. And the Skins of Columbus project, maybe I could say a quick thing about it, was an extension of the same spirit that motivated the Signs of the Americas project, which is to take seriously forms of intertextualization, that is to say, literature and culture that, for various reasons of intellectual arrogance, tend not to be taken seriously as literature and culture, or historically have tended not to be taken seriously. So not only pictographs, hieroglyphs, and quipu, but also dreams, magic, shamanism, and Skins of Columbus is within that broader spirit that motivates my work, an attempt to take seriously the historical content of dreams, especially of colonial dreams. And what that means in practical terms is that for the 3 months during which Columbus traveled the coast of the Americas, I read his journal entries before going to sleep at night, forcing myself to think intently on the symbols, motives, logics, landscapes, actions, to make myself dream this journal and see how it reticulated, connected, networked in my sleeping mind, in my subconscious. Now, of course, because it's my dreaming mind, it's also entangled with family history. So a number of the essays and the poems in there are about my family's migration histories from Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador. And one way in which I've come to describe the synthesis of these two works is in terms of anthropological poetics. And one person that has helped me to think about what anthropological poetics could be is Cecilia Vicuña. And Cecilia Vicuña, as you know, appears at the end of Signs of the Americas and very much serves to give the book its conceptual culmination. And that conceptual culmination happens in a lot of ways in response to a question you asked very early in our conversation, which was about loss and disappearance. And in Vicuña's works, loss and disappearance have two main meanings. On the one hand, because she's working with quipu, or Andean knot writing, that is a type of writing produced by cords pendant from a main cord, the semiotics of which are produced by the distance between the knots on the cord and their shape, and sometimes their color and the texture of the fabric through which the K-N-O-T knots are made on the cord. It's a kind of binaristic writing for which we have a semiotics, semiotic understanding, but not an entire semantics. We haven't filled out the meaning of this science system yet. In any case, Vicuña works a lot with the quipu, which are shot through with a sense of disappearance in as much as they were one of these sign systems deliberately destroyed by colonial powers and then over time erased through various forms of prohibition on reading or communicating through the quipu, which contained not only accounting information, numerical information, statistical information, but narrative, poetry, and history as well, in the same way that you might think of a Mayan codex. In any case, that's one of the nodes of disappearance in her work. And then the other node of disappearance is the forced disappearances by Latin American free market dictators in the 20th century extending to today. That is to say, the disappearances of people. This, of course, happened very prominently in Vicuña's home country of Chile, listeners will know, was a practice common throughout the dictatorships of Latin America in the 20th century. And in many ways, her works are trying to bridge these two disappearances, these two kinds of disappearances, to think of them in a continuum rather than a historical separation. And in doing that, in thinking about disappearance of the Americas as the main things to which any poetics of the Americas has to respond, what I call anthropological poetics is really feeling that disappearance and silence and loss are not the only things to be described. That there are worlds in what seems to be emptiness, in what seems to be disappearance, in what seems to be loss. It's Cecilia Vicuña who has taught me that world-bearing way of thinking about the poetics, the cultures of the Americas. That is to think of them not only as attenuated, disappearing, destroyed, otherwise forever lost cultures and histories, but very much a part of a living present that is pressing upon us at every moment.
When this language disappeared, all that was left was these words ending in I. Why was that? Madre del I. Liquidai solontai alquintai 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 solontai.
All right, that's all we've got for you today. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with Edgar Garcia. If you want to delve more deeply into Edgar's work, the books we've been discussing are Signs of the Americas, A Poetics of Pictography, Hieroglyphs, and Quipu, published by the University of Chicago Press, and Skins of Columbus, A Dream Ethnography, published by Fence Books. The performances you heard dispersed throughout this piece were, in order of their appearance, Alba de Habla by Cecilia Vicuña, Tu Ira es el Oro by Cecilia Vicuña, Nepantla by Gloria Anzaldúa, and When This Language Disappeared, which was also by Cecilia Vicuña. The theme music for this episode and for all my episodes was composed by Andre Popazuda. A big old thanks to Carmen Mirport-Quiñones for her editing, encouragement, and great ideas. I'm David Goodhertz, and you've been listening to New Books in Intellectual History. So long, and stay safe.